Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Thuy Vu. I'm a Bay Area journalist and TV reporter and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight's program is being held in association with Ascend as well as the Bay Gourmet Forum. It's also part of the Commonwealth Club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our very special guest tonight, world-renowned chef Charles Fahn of San Francisco's famed The Slanted Door restaurant and author of a new book, a cookbook, Vietnamese Home Cooking. Chef Fahn received the James Beard Award for Best Chef California in 2004. And in 2011, he was inducted into the James Beard Foundation's list of Who's Who of Food in America. So please welcome Chef Charles Fahn.
Thank you.
I read your book. I read it for like the whole week right before going to bed. The best nighttime reading ever. It is gorgeous. It's just so delicious looking. The photography is beautiful, not of just food, but of street scenes in Vietnam. And I noticed that, in fact, the first photos in the book aren't of food at all. They're of nightlife, of motorbikes, of markets in Vietnam. Why did you decide to structure your cookbook that way?
Well, I'm a little biased. I like Vietnam. the impetus for the book, over the years, people are kind of assume that you got a big restaurant, you should write a book, and publisher, would have lunch every year, and I always felt nervous about writing a book, and there's a reason. I personally don't like writing just because I like to do stuff with my hand. And in fact, I didn't graduate from Berkeley because of writing. and also, I think that for me, if I'm going to do something, it's got to be, having some major impact. I just don't want to do anything kind of halfway. And, traditionally, a restaurant would write a restaurant about their restaurant and the book about Slanted Door, and I just felt like it's going to look like a high school yearbook of me when I'm like 10, 15, 17 years younger. But more important, I think I want people to understand the Vietnamese aesthetic. The goal for me, this book, is for you to love Vietnamese food. Actually, my goal is not, I don't really care if you don't cook the food. More important, you learn how to eat the food. Because I think if you know how to eat the food, you will either cook it or you're going to go buy it from me or other restaurants. So because I notice in my restaurant, my staff have to tell people how to eat the food. And for me, food is about culture. It's about story. It's not just I'm some crazy artist try to concoct things and give it to you. For me, it's a lifelong mission of bringing a piece of Vietnam to here. I study architecture. My thing's about design. I wasn't really trained for a chef, but I just saw it working in high school, working in a restaurant. I saw a niche that no one was filling, that having modern setting in Vietnamese classic food, and the food's amazing. And I noticed how poor the quality of food in this country, especially Asian food, and I just thought it would be amazing, business model. So continue that quest of bringing story, bringing to you the Vietnamese aesthetic and sensibility. It might not to your liking. It just happened a lot of Vietnamese people like it.
But you might like Vietnamese like it too.
Yeah, what it does, it gave me the confidence. This is not wrong. This is how it's done. So because I never trained in the restaurant, hence with that, I needed a photograph. In fact, it was not even in our proposal to the editor, the publisher, that we would have spent all this money to shoot in Vietnam. But once I started doing it, they say, well, it's your recipe. You might not need the photograph. I say, no, you really got to get a glimpse of Vietnam because it's not what you think it looks like. In fact, some photograph people in down jacket looks like they're in Seattle. In Vietnam, it's like Seattle, you know, because if you go from Saigon to Hanoi, it takes you 2 hours. So,
When you were traveling through Vietnam, the landscape and the lifestyle and the cuisine and all that, how has that affected your cooking, and has it evolved over the years?
Yeah, hugely. I'm from Da Lat in central Vietnam. It's about 8 hour drive. I think it's 300 kilometer or something like that, north of Saigon. During the war, I couldn't go anywhere. You know, obviously there's not a lot of traveling. We would, I think in the 60s and early 60s and mid 60s, you would go to Saigon. By 68, after the Tet Offensive, you pretty much, it's pretty dangerous travel, especially if you come from a wealthy family. They will kidnap, you know, teenager and get them into the army. So I was not exposed to a lot of food, other regional food. But obviously there are some famous Hue dishes, but you really don't get the entire package. So now going back, definitely not the northern food. Obviously they're at war. So for me, going back to Hanoi and understand northern cuisine, or going to the Delta and try to understand that. I remember in Hoi An, which is an hour from Da Nang in the central region, where the Japanese and Chinese had used like a commerce area, you have a dish that is like literally Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, and all in one bowl. It literally had udon noodle and Chinese char siu and the Vietnamese herb all in one bowl, and literally you can see that culture that all melt together in that area. And they would have a little Chinese ha gao, like a shrimp dumpling, but they call it rosebud because they don't want to call it like a Chinese, so they make it look like a rosebud. So it's amazing, and Vietnam is changing rapidly. You can get sushi now in Vietnam, and you can get, you know, Spanish tapas and Kentucky fried chicken. So all that stuff, it's influenced Vietnamese cuisine, and for me, you know, I really want to understand before it changes too much. And obviously, you can't help a chef. You know, if he eats a sushi, he's going to come back home and he's going to try to make something look like sushi. Mm-hmm. That's our nature of a chef. So as other cultures are finally influenced Vietnam, from architecture to, like, everything, music, video. I mean, I'm sure they got rapper in Vietnam now, so.
And I know that we had talked, I had interviewed you, I think, beginning of this year, and back then you were working on the book. You had just returned from Vietnam, and you told me you were working on this cookbook. And you said you had visited a number of homes in Vietnam, tasted home recipes, ate with families in the hopes of maybe getting some secret family recipes and incorporating them into your book. How did that go?
Not so good. You know, it was kind of interesting. I get invited to home, and I had this whole thing about filming the refrigerator. It was hilarious. All they got, it was like Heineken and Coca-Cola, because they they got market. They can buy fresh every day. That was kind of interesting. And obviously, certain home cook will talk how great their, you know, bún thăng or like a Vietnamese northern dish. I think you will get inspiration. Sometimes multiple sources, multiple people will make the same dish, and you can really see sort of what is the kind of gold standard, if you will, of that dish. Like the dish I told you about in Hoi An, it's called gao lao. The noodle is made from the local, using some of the ash water. And by the way, it's really hard to ask for people with recipe. My wife's from Thailand, and I remember there's a little, like little cake place outside. I've been seeing this woman for 4 or 5 years, and I offer her $500 to tell me what's in there. And I show her my passport, and I say, I guarantee you I will not start a business in this country, and she won't give it to me. And she grosses like $50 a month, and I'm giving her 10 months, or, you know, and this is her only livelihood, and she doesn't trust it. And even as tempting as $500 US cash. So what I do, I just go back and eat like 10 times and try to memorize what I ate and write down what I ate. And that's what you got to do, is that you really just don't come back and tell me it's great, it's amazing, you know, I had a ball, and that doesn't help me making the food. So my staff go taste something, and they always go, oh, man, it's amazing. I was just like, well, what happened? It's amazing. I was like, well, that's not going to help me. So what I do, I go back, and I really write, okay, is it crunchy? Is it soft in the middle? It's amazing. It's this little rice cake, and it's gooey in the middle. And I finally stand there long enough to realize he's pouring two batter. He's pouring the first batter to coat the pan. The pan's hot, so it gels up. I think it's in Thai words, nong gong. I mean, my wife's going to kill me with that pronunciation. But so you would gel up, and they would have a coconut milk that pour right in the middle. They all white, and you thought it's the same thing. And I was like, how the hell did they get this crunchy and soft gooey in the inside? Turns out there's two batter. And they had two bowl, the two little kettle, and they look exactly the same. So.
And have you been able to duplicate it?
Kind of.
Will we see an appearance at one of your restaurants, that particular dish?
Yeah, we do it at home. It's a Thai thing, so I don't do Thai in my restaurant. I do it in my closet at home, you know. So.
I have to say that he is a man of the people, because we did a whole show on chef's picks, right? Where do they like to go out to eat? I thought he was going to take me to some five-star dining establishment. I'm going to eat with Charles Fahn. Life is good. He takes me to the Tenderloin, not one of the best neighborhoods in San Francisco, but he took me to a place called Lers Ras Thai. Wonderful. And 2 weeks after we went, it landed in Michael Bauer's top 100 new restaurants list, that little restaurant. So the man knows his food. And your wife is Thai.
Yes.
Has that influenced your cooking at all?
I know more about Thai things. I mean, if I didn't marry Thai, if I married a German girl, I'll probably know more about German, but I married a Thai girl, so I just know a little bit more about, you know, because we go back and go up north and start really understand the cuisine in Chiang Mai. But everything influenced my food, you know. I could be in the northeast eating a scallop, cooking with another chef, or learning about lobster and how they grow. Because all that, what you do is you harness all that and you put it into your context and you put it into your technique. And this book is really about trying to get you to understand each of these techniques. And the more you understand them, all makes sense. Like in the soup chapter, you know, like I realized most French guy will bake their bone, roast their bone, make stock. And the Vietnamese doesn't do that because the Vietnamese doesn't have oven. It's not in our repertoire, home oven. Maybe today, you know, like, you know, today I'm sure, you know, the big conglomerate would get oven into their fancy home, but traditionally we don't have oven. So what we do is we blanch the bone in hot water and we throw out the water to coagulate the bone, to coagulate the blood so that all the impurity doesn't float too much. And you blast it and all the impurity make your stock, you know, cloudy. Well, the French does it, and all these principles are very similar. They have mirepoix, they got celery and carrots. It's a little sweeter. We have it sweeter too, but we don't sweet too much. So we don't use celery and carrot. We just use onion and ginger, and we roast that. We caramelize that on a fire or in the oven. So as you start cooking and understand these principles, it all kind of makes sense, you know. And the wok chapter to describe about, you know, the principle of wok. That's why I didn't want to write a recipe, just a bunch of recipe, because I never follow recipe. And I know a lot of, in fact, I was at Google today and a lot of these young gals and say, my mom never measured anything, but that's how you should cook with this food. You really got to start, feel it and taste it along the way, because you're dealing with a lot of moving parts. These are all kind of, you know, fish sauce, they're not made by Google, you know, they're cottage industry. So you can't rely on the tasting the same every time. You're talking about live flesh, right? Scallop, fish. So you got to start understanding the principle to get to the food.
Let's talk a little bit about your background. You're an immigrant from Vietnam. What year did you come over and how did you get to the United States?
My folks are Chinese, or born in Dalat. We left the day it collapsed in May 1st, 1975. Got on a ship and bopping around the ocean for a little while, like for about 7 days. It's supposed to go to Singapore, it takes about 2 days, but The guy said he knew how to drive there, but he didn't. We were floating out there, and we picked up by a Malaysian patrol boat, and up in Singapore. At that time, none of the country in Southeast Asia wanted to take any refugees. I think the only one that really wanted to take some would have been Taiwan. All the other countries were just strictly, they don't want any refugees. Then they rounded us up. We were in a Singapore harbor for about 3 weeks. Then they put us in a bigger ship with better navigation and food, and we were sailed to Guam. Then I believe I landed in Guam sometime in late July, so about 2 months in the ocean. In Guam was about 300,000 refugee folks in a big camp. You get up every day, you wait in line, the military people cook for you, and they have eggs that are made from powder. That's the only thing I remember. And at night, and I guess they have classes, you go to classes, and at night they have big theater, and Tower Inferno was the movie at the choice at the time. And then they start spreading the refugee all over the country, putting on plane to ship them, whatever they get to ship them. Pendleton was the camp here in San Francisco. That's why you end up people like in Minnesota, like the Hmong folks. I'm sure you've watched Mr. Eastwood's movie, the Hmong folks, upstate New Orleans, the fishermen, the shrimper in New Orleans. And we chose to stay in Guam. And we stay in Guam, a refugee. Some folks sponsor us out of the camp. We worked for them for a year and a half, and then we came to San Francisco on our own. We're still flying Pan Am. Some of you still remember that airline. We still have a bag. A customer actually brought me a bag.
From Pan Am?
Yeah, he heard about my story, and he brought me. It was pretty emotional. I saw that bag, a little blue bag. And we've been in San Francisco ever since 1977.
We actually have a lot of similarities. I was also at a refugee camp in Guam, and I fled in 1975, too. Probably saw you somewhere among the 300,000 people there, eating, waiting in line for those eggs. What were your early years like in the U.S.? Were you cooking for your family even then? How did that come about?
Yeah, in the beginning chapter, I don't know why. Like, I guess I like cooking, and Mom had two jobs. She got to San Francisco, and she ended up working for a company called Ben Davids. It's a gorilla logo, make a painter's pant. This family from New York moved here, started this garment company, and she was with the garment union worker. Then she worked in Chinatown after work, worked for, you know, sewing shop, quote-unquote sewing shop, you know. And I had to cook, and Dad was working in a English pub, janitor, and I start cooking. And in fact, I remember I ended up cooking Thanksgiving dinner. I decided to cook this Thanksgiving dinner in a Wedgwood stove with no hood in Chinatown for my family, try to assimilate, you know, getting everybody excited about this culture. And they put up with me, and they ate it. At the end, they go, you know, we still want some rice, you know. I had mashed potato and all the fixing. But since then, every year we have Thanksgiving the traditional way, you know. I always throw in a little weird stuff now, like a gumbo or some other thing on top of the turkey, you know. But
we do a turkey and egg rolls. That's our favorite Thanksgiving meal. Obviously, all the ingredients from Vietnam were not available now. And now you can available then. Now you can find many of them in a lot of the Asian grocery stores. But back in the 70s, it was hard to find. How did you improvise trying to make Vietnamese dishes with the lack of supplies?
You know, it was funny. I don't know, I'm not sure I should say this because this is being recorded, but
sure you can. I'm a journalist. Trust
okay.
me.
Okay. All right. It's a client privilege here. I remember Mom brought back this little Vietnamese mint. I mean, it could have been just marijuana. I mean, it was, I think, early 80s, and somebody brought it back, and it was just, it's called Rao Rum. It was just like almost like contraband. And I think somebody smuggling it in here. And it was really easy to grow. But prior to that, in the early days, you would not find Rao Rum, Vietnamese mint. which is quintessential in our cooking. And I remember she brought back, and we stick it in the yard. Next thing you know, the whole yard was just taken over by this thing. You know, and all this stuff is happening in San Francisco. For instance, the chicken, you know, the chicken we eat today, it comes from a breed called Cornish cross. It is designed to grow very fast. It's just designed for a corporation. It's not designed for us to eat. It's designed to make profit. And we're like so sick of this chicken because it's had no texture. And all, not just the Vietnamese, the Chinese. So they start eating these chicken that are laying egg called Rhode Island Red. And well, those chicken weren't designed to eat, but they have texture and muscle. So they start eating the egg-laying chicken. And over the year, I think in Chinatown, they were start, we call it yellow feather because we don't know what the breed it is. It weren't white feather. So you go to Chinatown today, you will see what's called yellow feather. And it priced much higher. And it takes, almost, instead of 6 weeks, it's 12 to 14 weeks. They're like much lighter, but a lot more muscle. So, in fact, all our soup, the chicken noodle soup is used at Chinatown. It's much more expensive. Instead of $4 or $5 chicken, these are $12. Wholesale, $10 per chicken. Not by weight, $10. And they're like it's $4 or $5 a pound. So if you compare it to, let's say, a commodity chicken at $1.40, $1.20. So, the food here, it just all skew. And we want to eat chicken every day. But in Vietnam, you don't eat chicken every day. You know, you eat it, special occasion.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with world-renowned chef Charles Phan of San Francisco's famed The Slanted Door restaurant. He's talking about his new book, Vietnamese Home Cooking. I'm Thuy Vu. Do you cook at home, or are you so sick of cooking by the time you get home that you'd rather be doing something else, drinking your bourbon?
No. She married a cook, so I'm cooking at home.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you cook for your family at home, for Encana and your three children?
The other day, my brother just brought home 20 tombo tuna. He's a fisherman, and I stay up 2 in the morning canning tuna. I don't know why I was doing that. The other night, I made, I pull out the Zuni book, and I got, preserved lemon, which I made, and olive and caper and tuna that I made, at 2 in the morning. The next day, they had tuna and pasta. I love cooking, and our kids are spoiled, so we go from, we have a wood fire inside our apartment. We can do a paella. And if I get really bored, I call Delfina and order some pizza.
Their pizza is awfully good.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the thing, I can't go cheap. My kids are completely spoiled, so everything is first class. So.
Gourmet eaters. I know that you like to go camping to unwind. Do you cook when you go camping too, or do you actually relax for once?
No, I don't. I can't sit still. In fact, I brought the entire catering tools, and my son, he was 5. He thinks we were out in Samuel Taylor Park. I don't camping enough. And I got really bored, so I went down to Belize and got like a couple stick, and I Jerry Rick a rotisserie chicken that I did a paella. He thinks that's how camping is. Like I literally have rotisserie pork loin and grilled peaches for breakfast on campsite. But because I get bored very easily and I can't sit there. So for me, the joy of hanging out with the kid making food.
Whatever happened to hot dogs, hamburgers?
Yeah, we do it too, but we make our own hot dog. We make our own hamburger.
From scratch.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a place up in Napa. Sometimes, like, I miss all the store and I don't want to buy a lousy store. So I would get the yeast going at Friday night at 2 in the morning. And so hopefully I get some bread the next couple of days,
Gosh.
And once you learn it, it's not that big a deal. And it's only your family, They don't know you cook bad food. They just spit it back out and they don't eat it and nobody complains. So, that's the key. It's like you can't be worried about this stuff. You got to start doing it. It's just like a dance. Like once you learn the move, you got it, By the way, I don't have any dancing moves, but.
You'll have a lot of cooking moves. So your book actually focuses quite a bit on technique. because it's your belief that once you have the techniques down, you can cook just about anything.
Yeah, you really have to understand the principle. Like the grilling section, everybody just want to buy them. You know, they go to Home Depot and they see this shiny stuff, and I'm going to get that. And or the wife say, I'm going to get the husband that. Well, that's not where it goes. You really, like for me, if you understand, like having a simple Weber charcoal grill is the best. And I started with gas grill, fancy gas grill, a lot more than the Home Depot one. And I came back to cooking with live fuel, but it's just really understanding it. But we're so, you know, caught up in these sort of brainwashing ads that we go to a store, we buy briquette that are a little square thing. Those things are impossible to light. Well, if you buy mesquite charcoal, they are naturally wheat from Texas and Mexico. They got jagged edges. You know, you build a fire. It's very easy to build a fire. But if you build a fire with a bunch of square wooden block, it's very hard because there's no aeration. And if you build it and you know that in your mind that it takes half an hour to build a fire, then you wouldn't trip about it. Then you would build the fire and you go cook your rice, you get your vegetable. Then you're not in trouble with your wife because you're not late, because you had planned that you need half an hour to build your fire. But of course you come home and you're freaking out and you're already late and you're being yelled at. And you don't know a fire, and you think you want to buy the gas grill, but in turn, not really. You should build a fire, because that's why in the book, the fire is on the side. Don't put it in the center. People are symmetrical. We're symmetrical. We put everything in the middle. Well, you put the fire in the middle, everything gets hot, and you don't have any moving spot to move to get your form grill. Next thing you know, you have this giant fire, and people tell you to get a little water gun and squirt at it. Well, you squirt at it, the ashes goes in your food, and it's a big old mess. No, you put the fire on the side, because even if it's round, you put it on the side. You rake it, you go high to low, then you move your food around. You got to control what you got in your hand, and it become a craft. And pretty soon, you'll call yourself like a master grill king. You know?
And ladies and gentlemen, that is how you do a fire. Let's talk about your chef career. When did you realize you were a chef and wanted to do this for a living?
Yeah, you know, I don't use that word too much. I just think I'm a cook and a business person. Well, you know, we started 94 and things are going good. Things were time, you know, we didn't have any money and we just, you know, precarious. People might think we're like just great, but, you know, we were like refugees still. We're bopping around three different places. You know, the business was, the lease was up and we can't be there. We moved to Brandon Street and we don't have a lease. And there's time that is like, I don't know what I got. I mean, it was just like, you know, I guess, you know, I want to find out how long it takes. Unemployment will carry me. But you just, you know, one of the things I told my staff, you got to think like a refugee, because if you just deal one thing at a time and not worry too much and just let the thing play out, sometimes just better, because sometimes you freak out too much and you just, you know, kind of throw in the towel too early, you know. I think if you got your family and you got, you know, there's ramen noodle, right? It's not very expensive. So you could always revert back to ramen noodle for diet. So for me, it's always about, you know, building. And I guess this is my career, you know. Who knows? I might turn into a chicken farmer if I get bored with this. I really don't really want to stop thinking and changing and being good. I mean, at some point, if this thing start bored me, I give it up or hand it to somebody else and start growing chicken, because there's not enough good chicken in this town.
Your first restaurant, the Slanted Door, was in the Mission. I remember eating there and thinking, wow, this place is good. And I'm very picky about Vietnamese food, because my mom is a fantastic cook, so I have a specific palate, things I'm looking for. Where did the name Slanted Door come from for your first restaurant?
When I was in school, you know, in Berkeley, you know, architecture student, and mostly at the time, the Asian kid was in the math, and a lot of stereotyping that people, you know, and I always want to prove that wrong by doing design work. And I think things changed a lot since the 80s. And So when we opened Slam Door, I was very well aware of so-called the race card and people stereotyping, and I really want to change that. So I want to give a name that you don't know what the hell you're getting. So to call it like Google or some weird name so you don't expect anything. If I call it Vietnamese restaurant, the other day a reporter asked me, you encounter racism. I said, it's the only thing I ever encounter is like some guy want free tea in my restaurant because they say Chinese restaurant get free tea. And I go, you know, number one, I'm not Chinese restaurant and you're not getting free tea. But at the same time, it's stereotyping. You know, I mean, I got folks that come to my restaurant and say, where's the bread? And I say, do I look like a Mediterranean restaurant to you? You know, so people are expect certain things. They come to food, they don't think through about it. So I don't worry about that. So the idea with Slam Door was to create something that you can't expect anything because I want to do wine, I want to do American dessert, I want to do Vietnamese food, I don't want to call it fusion. So the idea was kind of hip, and our friend confused the door was slanted, but the whole wall was slanted. And when she said that, we all kind of, she wanted to call it slanted eye, actually. And it was a joke to tease me because as she was an Asian American study major at Berkeley, where I was in Berkeley at the time. And so she'd say, isn't your door slanted? And we all just knew that term. She didn't even say it. And it is a little touchy about the race thing, but since I'm Asian, I guess I can do it. But it's really, it talks about race. It talks about, you know, yes, you can enjoy this food in any setting. It does not have to pigeonhole to thing. And one of the most fondest memory I had was I was cooking at the Master in Carmel. This is a fancy, you know, $400 per person. Every year they got guy from France and 3-star, Michelin 5-star. I don't even have any star. And they brought me down, and I did. I had a lady chef, old lady, that she taught me a lot, and we make this called bánh cuốn. You know, we steam. Yeah. We make a tambourine. It's in the book. It's super hard. Try it with care, you know. And you make a tambourine, and you steam this batter. That you make the batter 2 days in advance, a day in advance, and you peel it up with this stick, and you make this paper skin. The entire kitchen shut down and surrounded us and watched us. And these are like big time chefs from all over Europe, and they just never see anything. We were relegated to this dessert section with a little Bunsen burner, and they were fighting over the kettle and the hood and all that. It just goes to show you that, you know, when you break it all down, people love food, and it doesn't matter where you come from. If you're making something really they haven't seen before, it's interesting.
So you, from the Slanted Door, you now have sort of a restaurant empire. You have, what, 6 restaurants now? Name them. Do you remember all of them?
I try not to count them because it's I think I have 5. I think at Heaven's, Slanted Door, we do food in the Academy of Science. I'm very proud of that. I think the board went out and tried to get some local chef to bid on that. We want to change the way people eat in the museum, eat food. Same thing, why we built a restaurant in the mall. Unfortunately, we lost that restaurant. Then we have Wu Hing General Store. That's the original store, the original spot in the Mission. We end up turning around and do a Chinese restaurant with cocktail. We have Heaven's Dog, also a Chinese concept. But my next coming project will be a bourbon concept with Creole food. We're collecting these vintage bourbon that is out of production. In fact, we were going through eBay, and finally eBay last week shut down the entire liquor purchase because of, I guess, underage drinking or something. That's coming up in the fall.
So you're busy.
And there's a couple more that I'm not allowed to say yet, but it's in the pipeline. So, yeah. We want to do interesting work. Our model is a little different. We have a central kitchen, so we have an R&D center where we develop these food, and and we have a catering company called Green Cap Production now. We do a lot of travel a lot, do a lot of charity cooking all over the country. This year was, you know, got all the way to Vienna because the Austrian Wine Board, we've been selling Austrian wine.
You do engage in quite a bit of philanthropic work. I mean, I think I saw you at the Monterey Bay Aquarium event, their annual fundraiser. You were cooking there in your little corner, fried chicken, fabulous fried chicken that day. But you're also involved with organizations that help Vietnam as well.
In our business, a lot of chefs get asked to do charity work, and we're kind of sucker. We say yes all the time, and a lot of time they will just give us room and board and airfare, and we do it, and, you know, with labor, we cover. And it's part of the camaraderie among chefs. Yes, like Meals on Wheel, Project Open Hand, you know, you feel like giving back. It's food and...
One Vietnam?
Well, the One Vietnam thing is a fairly recent thing. I was invited to be on their board. This is a organization, fairly young. It's sort of like a, kind of like a, look like a Facebook, but it's designed for you to donate money back to Vietnam. Get on that site. There's a lot of great tips. They got a lot of people in Vietnam posting log about where to eat and stuff like that. But the whole idea to attract the expat community, you know, sort of like the Obama wave at $5 at a time to send back to Vietnam. Our company, I think the family want to focus on, you know, kids' lunches, and I'm working on, you know, with the school district, try to find ways to, you know, change that, because we all know that the school district don't have very good food, if I can say that. And unfortunately, they don't have a lot of money. It's $1.50, and you can't make good food with $1.50. That's a direction I like to go and continue forward. But we always get to ask. A lot of the food festivals, I'm traveling almost like every once a month or twice a month. We're doing project like all the way to Hawaii Food and Wine Festival, or next week it's New York Food and Wine Festival. It's all about, you know, it's hard to say no to your colleague.
Yeah.
And they have a great party when you get there.
So. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and we're talking with world-renowned chef Charles Phan of San Francisco's famed The Slanted Door restaurant. He's here to talk about his new book, Vietnamese Home Cooking. I'm Thuy Vu. We have some questions from the audience today, and I'm going to group some of them together. Some people are planning to travel to Vietnam, would like you to be their travel guide. I'll just do a synopsis. For the adventure traveler, how do you spot the really great restaurants? How do you go about getting the best dishes? What advice do you have for them to enjoy the local foods?
Well, before you leave, you need Pepto-Bismol, diarrhea pill, and some itching medicine, and off. So you got to get those in. That's just not because I'm sure there's some bugs you're going to catch, but probably because you're overeating over there. When I travel, I overeat. I eat six meals a day. No wonder I get sick, right? You're bound to get sick in the water. I think the trick is to use your common sense. Like, if you're not sure, like raw fish or salad, stay away from those. If it's hot food, most likely it's going to be fine. Vietnam, more than ever now, I've been going back since the early 90s, it's amazing that a lot of money and a lot of expat, there's just a lot of restaurants that tourists don't even need to go, because the local is so long line that they don't need to cater to the tourists. So they don't have menu in English, for instance. But there's a great expat community. If you can find them and get tipped, because there is no Yellow Pages or Yelp in Vietnam to look for things. The market is a great place to start in the morning. These markets, they're called, you know, wet market. You can buy souvenir like at a quarter of the price, but the wet market is, you see the raw meat, like there's a market in downtown Ho Chi Minh City, Chợ Bần Thành, and you see raw meat sitting on the table and hardly any flies, no refrigeration. And those people just, oh, it's gross. But really, if you think about it, you smell it. You didn't smell anything, because nothing is rotten. Everything is killed that morning. It's going to consume that day. It's gone. And there's no expiration date. There's no saran wrap. So really, there's a lot of food vendors that cater to those market people, and they sell the food, and you get those food. And use your imagination. If you see really busy, a lot of people waiting in line, just get in line like everybody else. Chances are you couldn't be that bad. Then again, if you, people do get very sick, like friends that gotten sick from raw ceviche in Peru and stuff like that, then those are a little hard to tell, but in general, the hot food is really, really good. And a little trick, like you look at how much water they got, how the dish is being washed. They don't have a lot of to-go container, plastic bag, and so on. But sometimes as simple as, like, one of us got sick from the sugarcane juice, you know, and it's fresh and it's rolling. But what happened is a lot of flies around the sugarcane press, and they probably got infected at the press. So you kind of have to get smart about it. I mean, as simple as sugarcane juice, that, oh, I can't possibly get sick from that. And as my buddy Ole Lundberg, the architect, and he looked, you know, he's like 280, and he looked like a train had just ran over him. but he was a good sport, and he only skipped one dinner that night. So.
And one of my relatives also had a great tip with the Pepto-Bismol or any other kind of similar medication you bring. When your first 3 days in Vietnam, take one before every meal. It kind of helps to coat your stomach and kind of soothes your stomach. That way you don't get sick from anything you might eat. And by the third day, your stomach should have assimilated and you should be fine. Then you won't get sick at all. It works for him. It's worked for his friends. I've spread that tip to many people, and it seems to work for a lot of people.
Well, the problem with Vietnam is Walgreens had not gotten there yet. So, you know, you're not going to, I mean, half the stuff is expired, so bring your stuff. So if you need Tylenol, bring it, because you do not want to try to look for Pepto-Bismol when you got a problem. So, and even like things like, you know, getting mosquito bite and itching, you know, like it's just impossible because, you know, it's if you know where you're going, but in Vietnam it's harder.
Yeah, it's not like here where you have a pharmacy or a drugstore on every corner. Yeah, have your stuff ready. For those who don't go to Vietnam but want to stay here and are inspired to attempt some of your recipes, here's a question from the audience. Where in the Bay Area do you get Vietnamese herbs and spices?
Well, Larkin Street, there are quite a bit. The Alamany Market, San Jose is great. And that's why I think the book, like I said, you got to learn how to eat this stuff first. Don't worry about cooking it. Go to a lot of Vietnamese restaurants. Get it in your head. You got to get the visual thing in your head. The more visual you have, the more it's going to help you make the food. A lot of the herbs are a little harder. If you in the San Jose is huge Vietnamese community. There are a lot of mall. They're almost like food court, like in Tully. You probably can help me with some of the places in
San
Jose.
Yes, in San Jose, Grand Century Mall. Ranch 99 Market is a chain. They have many grocery stores throughout the Bay Area, in Fremont as well, and other locations, not just in the South Bay. But there are quite a few Asian
but
grocery
also,
stores.
But also, like, don't freak out. I mean, it's just, if you can't find Vietnamese mint, get an American mint. It's just somewhere in the mint family. You can't worry about that. You're not going to stop everything just because it's not Vietnamese mint. You know, if you do a salad, and there are a lot of things in there, like cabbages, you can get in Safeway. You could make a food out of Safeway, you know, but you don't have to have all this thing. Vietnamese may be great, but it's just a part of it. It's really the way that we eat it, the way we eat this herb. Like if you have a fry roll with a red leaf lettuce, and Vietnam, they got a lot more different herb thing, but just get regular mint, you know, don't sweat it. I mean, the more you sweat, I mean, you got enough problem making the bloody thing. So for me, it's just like, I always like to use a phrase with my staff. It's like, you're like water going down the river. You hit a rock, just go around it. You know, don't run down a river like a robot. You just keep banging your head to the same rock. Just go around it. And even though if it's not 100% authentic, next time, I'm sure you make it authentic, and it could be your own little thing.
And in fact, a lot of mainstream grocery stores now, we're lucky to live here in the Bay Area, a lot of mainstream grocery stores like Safeway. I see a whole Asian section in my Safeway all the time, and they have all the spices and the fish sauce and the mint leaves.
Yeah, only thing you really need is, in fact, I think you're going to have more trouble finding a great piece of pork than you're finding fish sauce or chili. I mean, I really think your best place, probably go to the farmer's market, get an amazing tomato or get a great mango salad and some shrimp. You know, like the fish sauce, most likely you have in your cupboard, the sugar, you're going to make chili. If you don't have to use Thai chili, use habanero. You have a bottle of Tabasco if you have to. But really, if you've got a great shrimp, you're going to get 90% of that dish on the ingredient. That's what Slander has always been based on. It's a quality ingredient. The fish, the chicken that we buy, the meat we buy. So people kind of worry about all these little other things. But for me, it's always finding that great piece of pork that has not been chewed up with stuff the athlete use, you know? So.
Wow. That's quite a visual. You're sort of the accidental chef. I mean, I was reading your book, and there's a great photo in your book of when you were, I think, 14, 15 years old, and you're working on making some kind of ceramic object. And in it, you talk about your passion for ceramics early on. Do you still enjoy making ceramic objects now, and has that influenced your
yeah,
restaurants?
Yeah, I haven't made ceramics since college. I was a potter. I really loved ceramic. I thought I was going to be a potter. I just love, that's why Slander never had white plates, so we always use crockery. And that's why I'm very interested in ceramic cooking, clay pot. Clay pots is, you know, you just really, it does something to the food. The rate of transfer, the heat transfer, the loss of juice, the liquid loses a little liquid very differently. So I really love to cook with clay pot, and I do it in catering. What happened is the clay pot, it's hot, you bring to the table, continue bubble of the retention of heat. I don't even dream about pottery anymore. It's been so long. So.
This is a question from the audience. Fergus Henderson, the chef known for nose-to-tail eating, was also trained as an architect, like you. Do you think your training as an architect helped you to become what you are today?
Definitely. I think one of the things architect is trained to do is to synthesize problem and organize your problem. Whether or not it was a cooking problem or a spatial problem, in architecture you have, you know, aesthetic need, physical need, code need, you organize those. I think it does help me tremendously to break down whatever problem I have, whether it's a financial problem. And sometimes a lot of these restaurants, like Chez Panisse, I think a lot of people don't know how amazing Alice is in a lot of aspects of that company. And I was just there. We did a book event. We cooked at Alice's kitchen. And funny enough, in the second round, I had a cooking hearth, and it's burning, and I'm cooking, and the power went out. And it was Monday. It was hot as day. And the joke was I brought Vietnamese food to Berkeley, and I brought the weather, and I brought the rolling blackout, too. And we literally had a problem there. We had to put out the fire, and the smoke was in the room. And crazy enough, Alice got a generator and turned it on, and we're all good, you know. It's just amazing for an institution like that. She actually have a generator and get it through, and it was amazing. Everybody got their food, and for me, in this business, it's about really solving and not worry about what traditions say and, you know, from your staff and, it's everyday problem. You're paid to do a show at 5:30 every night. It doesn't matter what you did yesterday. It's always about today. And if I have a bad show today, and you're going to go tell, you know, 20 of your friends, you know, if I have a good show today, you might tell your wife. So.
And a lot of the people who are with your Slanted Door group have been with you for years. They're practically family now.
Yeah, we really try hard to do that, and I think that's something I'm really proud of. And it's always constant struggle, try to figure out, because like my head chef with Slander, she's been with me 17 years. She was 20-something, you know, party all the time back then, and now she got a kid that's 5, and I have to change, you know. When I have my kid, I had to give up the line and get away from the line and relinquish some of the cooking on the line, and now she had to do it, and now she had to relinquish the next generation up. And that's why we're building more restaurants and more different concepts, is because we just won the best bar cocktail because one of our guy, you know, was recognized the best restaurant bar in this country. It was actually competing with some European, too, by the tail cocktail. And it just attests to, you know, if everybody on the same mission, you can really build a great company. Not that I say I am a great company, but I feel like we have a nice little group together. Nobody, unfortunately, a lot of people don't know that, you know, we have an amazing wine director. We have this amazing Austrian wine list. And the cocktail, a lot of people in the industry knows about it, but often slander the food, the chef, Charles, you know, the company mascot just sort of take over. But we do have an amazing group, and we all have the same, you know, ideal and how to, and we all getting older, and I got to figure out how to, you know, find them the kids' college fund and so on, just like everybody else.
So early on, as you were running your first restaurant, as you were starting to formulate what you wanted to do with your future, forming your restaurant group, were there early difficult lessons that you have learned from?
Well, the problem is always changing. It's always like, you know, make sure we have money to pay bills, and it's always the same problem. And I think we grow our sale very well and on the top line, and we're like really busy, probably like supposedly somebody said we're like number one, number two in restaurant grossing. But to be frank, our profit not so hot. But you just deal one problem at a time, and it's always a problem. There's not really been the same problem. I'm not sure it's any different 17 years ago. I think that I'm a little bit more confident. I mean, you know, not everything. Like Wuhan General Store, it's not doing too hot. You know, just we went back. We were doing like gangbuster back then. For whatever reason, people not really drawn to the Chinese food thing. But I think one thing we could be proud of is like the food is, for me, it's fine. It's great to my standard. The cocktail is great. People don't come, well, so be it. Well, we'll hang on to it as long as we can. But if not, we'll turn into something else. Like, I'm not worried about, I think that's a different today than yesteryear. That yesteryear, I literally would not have rent money. Now, I kind of set things aside. Certain things not going to, I think, you know, we'll have rent money. But I don't think we're going to get rich anytime soon. But that's not important. I think it's about building things you like. People would say, well, you could have put it out the door there. But like, for me, it's just like, I would die if I had to make another spring roll in that same spot, you know. And it's about our, you know, our work, you know, and I'm sure we'll make a lot of money with Springwell and Valencia Street, but that's okay. Who knows? It might take a little longer. Well, you know, maybe after this show, everybody go to Wuhan General Store.
Yes, please do. Please help Chef Charles Vaughn keep his restaurant alive. And I know you're always experimenting with new dishes, new concepts, but are there certain well-loved dishes that you can never take off the menu? There might be a mutiny, spring rolls?
Yeah, spring roll, shaking beef. I mean, that's just part of the process of restaurant because people wait, especially Slandor, they wait 3 weeks and get a reservation. They show up and they can't find the shaking beef and they probably want their money back. No, I mean, that's just, but it's a fine line because we have to keep product fresh, and so sometimes we literally take it off the menu just so that our staff can create something new. But they want both. They want the same old, they want something new. And it's like this schizophrenic thing, and I'm not ballsy enough to be like Chez Panisse where new menu every day. That's just a whole different school that we kind of got ourselves into, and it's just a pattern. But that's fine. It's just drawing that balance to like just it's a struggle every day. Oh God, can't take that. I'm, you know, so and so is going to be mad. But sometimes we hide them in the back. It's not on the menu, like shaking beef, and you ask for it, and we'll give it to you if you really cry about it. But we try to get you to eat some other new things. So,
are you ever interested in doing fusion cuisine? French, Vietnamese, Mexican, Scandinavian, do you think that will ever be more than a niche in the culinary scene?
Well, the word fusion is kind of a funny thing to for a lot of funny people. And, you know, I would never do, you know, wonton with foie gras or cheese inside my wonton. That, you know, just throwing anything. That was the 80s. But if you look at the food, how, you know, the French had influenced Vietnam, we have baguette, we got a lot of this food that are influenced. But today, the technique will influence, like I would do my scallop crispy, sear, unlike the blanching in the Chinese tradition. That's strictly influenced by what I learned from Nancy Oak at Boulevard, right? Or Gary Danko or David Kinch, you know, making a perfect scallop. So for me, that is just by being in this country, you're going to get all these fusion. But for me, I really try not to go too far into the gas, the plastic bag, and because I can do that separately at a different venue. But if you sell the story at Slam Door as selling a Vietnamese experience, then you have to stick to it. And I try to get my staff to understand that. And our thing is really about taking local ingredient and making it a Vietnamese way. So I really don't want to get into an area like Jose Andreas. You know, he would have classic tapas and he'll do a decomposed gazpacho. Like for me, he separate that, he call it that, that's fine, but don't do it in the same spot because people expect like a classic imperial roll and they can't come and find out the you know, the rice paper and everything's all in pieces on the table. So that's not going to work, you know? So for me, it is fusion by definition because you learn about other chefs. Sometimes just ingredients, you know, as I travel in the Northeast, learning about the scallop or a particular fish. I just came back from New Orleans, having an amazing baked oyster. And, you know, and you steal these techniques or just even the type of ingredients each other chef use.
Did you ever imagine you would someday have this kind of impact on the way people enjoy and think about Vietnamese food? The Slanted Door was in many ways a game changer.
No. I don't want to think about that. It just sounds like kind of serious. I just want to do, you know, good stuff and hopefully somebody say nice things at my funeral. I do proud that I was able to push Vietnamese food in a serious way that Vietnamese people didn't say that I somehow botched it, you know. For me, I'm proud of that. But if I did that, that's great. But I don't think about the past. And, you know, I just want to. You know, hopefully, I can make some good Creole food going next. I don't know. You know, for me, I don't think about the accolade. I just want to do. Unfortunately, this stuff doesn't last very long. It lasts 2 minutes, and people eat it, it's gone. You know.
Your next restaurant, Creole. You brought that up. Why Southern, and where is it going to be?
It's next to, it's at Pier 3, next to Lamar Restaurant, not far from Ferry Building, a little tiny 1,300 square feet place at a little horseshoe bar. Ole and I, my architect, we're completely addicted to bourbon. I don't know why, we both just happened, when we built the restaurant, and I could have gone to scotch or tequila. I just enjoy bourbon, and maybe it's just in Vietnam, I grew up, my dad drinking a lot of cognac, that brown liquor. And we saw the space, and we just thought, this is a cool horseshoe bar. And we like bourbon, and I say, well, you know, New Orleans, and I love New Orleans food, and the oyster right by the ocean. So sometimes the space kind of invoke a particular idea, and you just build it. Then you find out, oh, my God, it costs $1 million. And I say, oh, God, geez. And you sign on a dotted line, it's too late, so you just go ahead and, like I said, just finish washing your hair. You already wet your hair. Just get on the shampoo and just finish it up. Yeah.
And that's an expensive shampoo.
Yeah. And the thing is, life's too short. Like, why? I mean, like, I don't, you know, just like, I don't want people to stereotype my Vietnamese food. I don't want to stereotype the other way. And we do too much stereotyping, you know, and it goes every direction. And I think you see this country, everybody is just focusing on preserving a particular history or a particular breed or animal. And we all have to do it because with this globalization, it's going to be gone fairly quick, and we're not careful. And as crazy as just within the last 20, 30 years of bourbon, half the stuff doesn't even exist anymore. We're running around the country in a car buying retail to put in this restaurant. And basically, some of these rick houses were burned down or gobbled up by a big conglomerate. We'll never see it. And if you understand the story, the thing tastes a lot better. Or I can talk you into it. You know.
This cookbook, it took you 17 years to come out with a cookbook, which is amazing because chefs are always turning out cookbooks these days. And if you read through it, it's really more than just a collection of recipes. It is the story of your life. When you look back at your life's journey from war refugee to celebrated chef, what comes to mind? How would you describe your life?
I'm just one lucky guy. That's how I see it. I get to experience all this stuff, and I get to eat and drink all this stuff, and I'm not sick. So at least I think I'm not sick, or overweight for that matter. No, it's just amazing. You get through it. It's funny, you know, like a friend of mine can't eat sardine, and it was a dish I served Japanese. And on the boat, you eat sardine and tomato. He freaks out. But for me, it just reminds me my trip on a boat, and just day after day is sardine and tomato, and it's just overcooked, and it's great. You know, for me, it's just a wonderful memory. And for me, I always look at the glass, half full, and you know, just fortunate you got through it and you got to experience that. You can brag about it. If I didn't, I probably wouldn't be sitting up here. You know.
Do you go back to Vietnam often? Do you still have family there?
Yeah, I don't see my relative too often. It costs too much to see them, you know. So
I got a lot of relation to the relative.
No, you're handing out like flyer on the street corner. You know, just handing out $100 bill. For me, I try to go to places I've never been before to learn about the food. I go minimum once a year. Now I start taking my staff back, like Justine, who's Irish, and she really understands where I come from to pass on the next generation. And I find that very useful because, because I blab so much, at some point they kind of stop hearing what I say. And it's just easier to see them, and you see where you come from. And sometimes you don't even know who you are until you see the other side. And my architect didn't really see what kind of food I made until he ate at a Vietnamese restaurant in Vietnam, and some of the same dishes. And somehow we have a little different touches. And just like everything, you know, the way you make them, the ingredient. It was a classic dish of crab and cellophane noodle, and we went to four places, and they say, couldn't believe, you know, how much they love my dishes, you know. So, yeah. Yeah, go soon, because Vietnam is changing rapidly. And pretty soon it will be so much high-rise and Lamborghini that you won't enjoy as much.
We've reached that point in our program where we have time for just one last question. So I'm going to make it a question from an audience member. It's a brilliant question, actually. What would your last meal be?
Well, yeah, it's kind of morbid to think about that stuff. I used to think of other activity than eating, but...
really? Like what?
I'm not going to say. I had a dish...
Are you blushing?
One of the dishes I had was a chef. He collected pork fat, come from the roast pork. And he steamed this perfect rice, and he got this super expensive soy sauce with two fried eggs, and he brought it to the table. And this bottle of emulsified fat that come with all the dripping of the herb, and we pour it on top of there, and the fried egg, and this amazing $40 bottle of soy sauce that was in Hong Kong. And that was sublime. That was just and perfectly fried egg. That was just, for me, I would say, if all things goes bad in the last meal, I just want to probably, doesn't matter what I eat, probably want to eat with people that I care, and probably a lot of bourbon, you know.
So it would be about the company, not the food.
Nah, food is food, you know. Food is food, but somehow that food does stuck in my head for a long time, that fat and rice and soy sauce.
That's a cheap last meal.
Yeah, yeah, so hopefully I don't have to eat that.
Well, you know, it's always fun to talk to you. It's like sitting down with an old friend. Well, I guess it sort of is, because we are friends, so it was a lot of fun. Our thanks to Chef Charles Phan of San Francisco's famed The Slanted Door Restaurant, who came to talk about his new book, Vietnamese Home Cooking. For all those here in the club, Chef Phan's new book will be on sale out in the library, and he'll be happy to sign it here in the Blue Room. And you're all welcome to sample his fabulous food. He brought some by, compliments of his Slanted Door restaurant. We're so grateful for their generous offering. And tonight's program was held in association with Ascend as well as the Bay Gourmet Forum. It's also part of the Commonwealth Club's Food Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also thank our audience here and on the radio. I'm Thuy Vu. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.